it's a quick election campaign, as short as it's allowed. What do you see as the top issues in Lanark Frontenac this time around?
Well, there's, I mean, first of all, whenever I get asked this question, I have to point out most people, as far as I can tell, vote on national issues, so that the issues are not actually that different here from what they'd be, say, just south of us in Leeds and Granville, or just north of us in Renfrew County. And for that matter, there's a certain similarity to what you'd get elsewhere, but there are rural and small town implications for some of the issues. So, you know, we have ongoing issues relating to the housing crisis and the rising cost of real estate and rents, which is tends in the media to get focused on as it appears in Vancouver, Ottawa, Toronto, and so on. But it has significant implications in small town areas, especially close to big cities. That's us. Many people moved both during COVID and as a result of changes in the idea of commute, being able to virtually commute out of the city. And that has exacerbated the overall housing shortage and lack of housing starts issue. So that's a huge issue. And affordability in general, we have inflation that's more than we've seen in several decades, since the early 80s. That is affecting people's well-being. And in particular, the way in which the problems that are created here are distributed is very inequitable and very unfair. So housing, if you're my age, I'm 61, you bought your house before the prices went up, Bob's your uncle. If you are the age of our kids, who are in their 20s, it is really tough trying to get your first home. It is much more expensive than it was for me 40 years ago. That's a huge issue. The issue of affordability in general, since the beginning of COVID, we've seen prices go way up. And those who are wealthier, those who are in the top quintile, if you divide the population to five groups, are actually better off than they were beforehand. Those in the bottom quintile are significantly worse off. And we see the way the effects of inflation have been distributed. Inflation and high interest rates is being that they have benefited those who are wealthier. Those who are poorer are hurt more. It's a perfect inverse correlation. So that is a problem. The rich are literally getting richer and the poor getting poorer, which is not the historic trend in Canada. Huge issue there. And of course, there's this is not local to us, but looking at what's going on with the Trump presidency is on everybody's mind. That cuts across all lines. But in general, to answer your question, issues that relate to small town and rural areas close to cities are the ones that would predominate here that you would see differentiating us from a place like Kanata or downtown Ottawa or Kingston.
So what would a Conservative government do to address all those issues you just mentioned?
Well, I just covered every issue I can think of. Yeah. Do you want to break that down and give me a narrower one to focus on?
Let's talk about housing.
Housing. Okay. So the first thing here is that we have a housing shortage because of things that governments have done. Some of those are decisions made by local governments and local officials who are, I think local building officials in a number of municipalities in this area are far too restrictive and are putting unreasonable costs. Governments in general, municipal governments, have driven up development costs. It's now a substantial part of their revenue base is to make it very expensive to build new houses. This avoids putting tax on people's existing houses or raising those, which may be good politics. It's bad for equity. Those who are wealthiest are those who already own their homes, especially larger homes. Those who are trying to get in to less affordable housing are being hit by the development charges placed on anybody who tries to build new housing. That's a huge and very inequitable issue. But that is driven, that's not federal, but the federal government does give massive grants to the provinces, who then pass them on to the municipalities. Sometimes they go direct to municipalities. And those should be tied to making sure that more housing is actually being created, which is not done right now. It's largely being used to fund bureaucracy under the Liberals. I think that is a huge problem. That has to be adjusted. So that's for the federal government to deal with. Secondly, we had this policy developed under the Liberals in the last few years of allowing very large numbers of people into Canada with no expectation of no plan for a place to house them all. So we've driven up the supply of people looking for housing. That has actually, I would say, affected people who live here less than it's affected the actual people arriving in Canada. I think some of them had no idea when they were on their way here just how expensive it would be to live here, just to have a place to live here. But you have to have some kind of practical coordination between how many people you're letting in and how much space there is to accommodate them. And that is very much under federal jurisdiction.
Now, you are one of the longest sitting MPs currently in the House. How do you plan to keep things fresh in the mind of voters? And do you see your long tenure as an advantage, so to speak, heading into another campaign?
Yeah, so I was first elected in November 2000. So it'll be 25 years later on this year. And there are, I believe I'm right in saying, if everybody who's running now wins again, there will be a total of five other MPs who have served as long as I have, and a couple have served a bit longer. So it's a good question. I think there's two things to say. One is, on certain issues, you get better at it the longer you're around. With length of tenure, increased expertise and knowledge, you become better at whatever you're specializing in and focusing in terms of policy in the House of Commons. So I think I've become an expert on constitutional matters, parliamentary procedure, the dynamics of caucuses. I've had a role in changing how the Speaker of the House is elected, a whole series of those issues. I think that you actually get better with time if you do that. Just in the last parliament, I proposed a way of changing the standing orders, which won the unanimous consent of all parties. And then locally, there's initiatives I've had for years that I continue to pursue. They are long-term initiatives. One of these is trying to get defibrillators into public spaces. For years, I donated a substantial amount of money. Those who have very long memories will recall that in 2000, when I was first elected, the Prime Minister announced after the election that MPs weren't being paid enough. He was going to give everybody a huge pay increase, but you could opt out of it if you wanted to. So I asked people what I should do with the money. It was about $25,000 devoted to some form of spending on the community, and I've been doing it ever since. So 25 years times $25,000, 25 years, $25,000 works out to a substantial amount of money by this point. Initially, it was defibrillators. More recently, it's been on giving money to shelters for women who are victims of domestic violence. That was during COVID when that was a big issue. And now, the last 2 years, it's been for the various community kitchens, food pantries that exist in each of our communities, because that, it seems to me, is where the greatest need is. So, working on that project, both on the narrow one, defibrillators, which my goal has been to try and get those into police cruisers everywhere. That would save a significant number of lives annually every year. I'm going to pursue that until I succeed in doing that. Then in terms of what I think really matters to folks locally, making sure that you keep track of their issues, which I continue to do, and very significantly, although you don't see it as much, having a really good staff in pursuing the individual issues that arise with people who expect, for example, a government benefit like Canada Pension Plan, and then something goes wrong, they don't get it, who have a problem getting, something else happens, is people need to get a passport reissued, someone who hasn't had one for many, many years, and collecting the relevant ID, like their birth certificate, turns out to be difficult because they're older and they didn't have a birth certificate, they had a baptismal certificate and a church that had a flood years ago, that kind of thing. Knowing how to do that quickly and efficiently, and that's something that a very experienced staff like mine is usually very good at doing.
Now, there's obviously been a recent significant shift in public opinion in the polls. The Liberals have really come back to life in what was originally and expectantly going to be a landslide victory for the Conservatives and Pierre Poilievre. What do you make of this shift in the political landscape, and how do you intend to maybe get some voters back?
Well, ultimately, voters are going to make decisions based on the input of people other than myself, writ large, outside of this riding, obviously, that's true. I think just pointing out the Liberal record has not gone away. It was a record of driving up our costs, spending like mad, in a very unsustainable way, causing an inequitable set of impacts, which hurts rural people more than urban people, young people more than older people, less wealthy people more than people who are wealthier. Those things are still there. And the current Prime Minister, Mr. Carney, is the intellectual author of some of these policies. So he's talked, for example, about he was the person who pushed hardest for the idea of a carbon tax, which he now says he disavows out of nowhere. He's got a book where he says the exact opposite. He says we should levy tariffs on countries that don't have a carbon tax of their own. So now he says he doesn't mean that anymore. What he'll do instead is put a carbon tax on manufacturers, so that'll hide it. But it won't stop us from getting it. It'll, of course, get passed right back to us through increased inflation. His policies would make you exactly as poor as you were before. We'll distribute the pain slightly differently. I don't know how, based on who buys what. But ultimately, if you buy food, you're going to pay more because it's going to cost more for the manufacturers. If you heat your home, it's going to cost more. Just it'll come out in the price of the oil or gas when you purchase it, as opposed to being a tax bill on the end. So anybody who thinks that hidden taxes are more efficient than overt taxes, by the way, no economist thinks that. But if you do, then this is the tax for you. But I think people will see through that personally. And I just think that once people concentrate on the fact that almost every area that is under federal jurisdiction, our ports, our criminal law, our airports, is almost all of these are just really badly administered. Our corrections system. The current prime minister has just arrived, has to demonstrate that he can actually do something to improve on this record. Or I think voters will naturally flow away from the Liberals.
And lastly, you mentioned it off the top. Of course, there's one huge national issue, and it's handling the ongoing trade war and dealing with an unpredictable president and Donald Trump. Why do you think Pierre Poilievre is best suited to be the one representing Canada in those discussions?
Well, I think the policy that the Liberals adopted of high-profile retaliation is the wrong policy. So if they pursue it, then I would say anybody who's pursuing an alternative policy is doing a better job. Look, we're dealing with Donald Trump is you've got someone who is a bully. I remember watching, actually I really disliked it at the time, but I remember occasionally I would see an episode or part of an episode of The Apprentice, his TV show. You know, it ended with him saying you're fired to people. He seemed to enjoy firing people a little more than, it was unseemly, frankly. But that's him, he's a bully. You know, his book, The Art of the Deal, is all about the art of the real estate deal, which is very different from other kinds of deals. Real estate is frequently a zero or negative sum game, where you put the other side, if you negotiate the way he recommends, you create maximum uncertainty for the person you're negotiating with, you block off their access to alternative methods of doing a deal with somebody else, and then you offer them an unreasonably low price when you've cut off their options. That's what he's doing on tariffs. It's interesting, he didn't do it his first term. He didn't think it was good policy then. Something's happened to make him think it's good policy now. But as a bully, like bullies, the way they act is they tell you, you'll do what I want or I'll cause you pain. If you try to fight back, they try to increase the pain to you. And they keep on doing it. There is some breaking point where they'll stop doing that. But we don't know what that is. We're in an asymmetrical relationship where they're, like the trade relationship for us is that, the same dollars, but you know, the United States is 10 times as big as us. So it's vastly more important for us than it is for them. We've got to be very careful about what we do. And look, you do high-profile retaliatory tariffs, which is Doug Ford tried that. He obviously can't issue tariffs, but he could say, we're going to go and put an export tax on hydroelectricity exports to the U.S. That blew up almost immediately when President Trump said he'll raise the tariffs on steel and aluminum higher than they already were going to be. Within 24 hours, at least at the most 48, he was in reverse. Something similar can happen if we overplay our hand on the wrong things, or if we play at the wrong time. You know, President Trump is trying to go and implement these tariffs on Canadian trade, Mexican trade, and every other country in the world. You don't want to be out there pushing back when he needs to show the rest of the world how tough he is in order to get them to comply. You need to wait to a point where he's not using you as his example. And so far, I haven't seen that. I think Justin Trudeau, when he was responding, created a situation in which he put a big target on Canada. You know, that was very unwise, and I hope that that will not continue. But there are things you can do. I would think we should look very seriously at some of the things written into existing arrangements between ourselves and the U.S. that where they are more vulnerable. And the most obvious one is copyright protection and patent protection, written in largely to benefit large American companies. Computer printers, for example, those are all American companies. The excessive penalties for people who want to get their printer toner from elsewhere under the Millennium Copyright Act, which was largely written into the legislation of other countries. I think we should be looking at whether or not we could roll that back, for example. And so you would wind up creating a retaliation that might not, A, attract Mr. Trump's attention to the same degree, and B, something that puts the pain on Americans, not on Canadians. So tariffs are not actually, the idea is I'm going to retaliate, force people to buy domestically. What you're really doing is you're taxing your own citizens. Every penny of our countervailing tariffs is going to be paid by Canadians. This is the Achilles heel of tariffs for the Americans as well. And all those tariffs where Donald Trump is saying we're going to pay for all, you know, we don't have to raise taxes, we're going to pay for so much of our spending with revenues from these tariffs. So that is really a way of saying a whole bunch of Americans are going to be paying for a tax that I get to impose by executive order instead of going through Congress the normal way.
You're saying retaliatory tariffs are not the correct way to approach?
High profile across-the-board retaliatory tariffs are a very bad idea.
So then how do we counteract the actions of the United States?
Well, I just mentioned the idea of going after intellectual property rights. That's an idea which I came across. Cory Doctorow, a Canadian science fiction author and commentator, suggested that one, and I've seen it come up a couple of times since then. How practical that is, I don't know. I'm not a trade expert. I think precise, targeted tariff responses that target individual states within the U.S., thereby causing individual senators and representatives to have an interest in going back into and countervailing, or running countervailing rather, but on causing the United States to be a bit more reasonable in its approach towards Canada are appropriate. The president has to worry about maintaining his majority in both houses of Congress, and if he sees key allies who are worried about losing their own seats, that's important. So I used Doug Ford as an illustration earlier. I thought the high-profile use of the electricity exports, I thought that was unwise. I don't have the same view on his pulling bourbon off the shelves on Ontario, the LCBO. That targets one specific part of the state of Kentucky, a red state. So if you're in Bourbon County, care a lot about this now. And the people care a lot about it now. And if they go and say, well, look, you know, the Republicans have created a huge problem for us, they might consider voting for the Democrats. President Trump loses his majority in the House of Representatives in a couple of years when they have the midterm elections. He would be looking potentially at impeachment hearings from the Democrats. He loses both houses. He's got a really serious problem. Now that impeachment and trial in the Senate has become a standard way of essentially having the legislative branch engage in a kind of vote of non-confidence against the executive branch, he has to worry about those things, and he has to worry about it before those elections occur, actually, because he has to take actions to prevent it. So you can have an impact, but I think you have to be targeted, selective, and you have to recognize, you know, you're dealing asymmetrically with a vast trading partner. It's a huge advantage regardless of for the U.S., regardless of who's in the White House, and that you're dealing with somebody who responds in a mercurial manner towards high-profile retaliation. You should be trying to think about how to do this in a way where specific parts of the U.S., they're feeling it, and that's how the message gets transmitted to the president, as opposed to something high-profile, which results in immediate retaliation.
Okay. I really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much.
All right. My pleasure.